Hello, dear listeners, and welcome back to Fight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast who would like to fly away from trouble, as would a politician's expense account. I'm Brendan.
I'm Nathan.
I'm Todd.
And we're going in for a spot of light green zone blowflies and torture in Vengeance on Tharos.
So this is a story that critiques us for watching it, isn't it? And we've had this before. Do you remember Carnival of Monsters, where Katie Manning suggests that we must be terrible people to want to tune in and watch her being chased by monsters? Here the same thing happens. And there's something a little bit brilliant about giving us a substitute audience to identify with. I want to leap in and say, I think this story is terribly overrated, but I do think that one of the best things about it is Arrak and Etta.
Yes, played by the wonderful Stephen Yardley, previously seen in Genesis of the Daleks as the Muto who helps Sarah.
Oh my goodness, it's Severin.
Yeah, it's Severin. He's also the XXY man from the series of the same name. He was in Day of the Triffids. He's a great actor. Sheila Reid, of course, classic actress, most familiar to Doctor Who fans as Clara's Gran.
Yeah.
I love the fact that they're the goggle box
yes.
of Doctor Who. Like, they are just a joy, Nathan. They're just a joy to watch. And the fact that they recorded all their scenes at the end of the recording block, so they actually pumped the images through the television, so they were seeing what the other actors are doing for the first time and reacting to that,
I think it
makes it even more glorious. And the whole framing of that within the story works wonderfully.
And my favourite moment is the cliffhanger to episode one where Colin's dying of thirst and both of them are thirsty, like they both want a drink of water.
I particularly love when he says, I'm going to go to bed, and tells her to vote for him, and she threatens to dob him in, because it's a Holmesian kind of world-building move. Yeah. I'm going to be critical of some of Philip Martin's writing choices in this. I don't think this is an overrated story. I do think this is one of the best quality stories of the era.
But I would agree with that.
Yeah.
But it's terrible.
But I think something Philip Martin does masterfully here, we do have Martin Jarvis occasionally telling us what this culture is like, but we have Arrak and Etta actually showing us in their interactions with each other. And because we're discussing them, let's jump to the last scene right now where they realize they're free and they don't know what to do with themselves with nothing on the television. It's weird because it's hopeful and it's funny and it's sad all at the same time that they don't know what to do. And I think ending a Doctor Who episode on a screen full of static is very daring at this time in history.
No, I love the ending. I love this. The previous time I watched this, I wasn't that in love with it. But this time watching it in order, I actually liked it even more. My biggest criticism, besides the crap power couple, which we'll come to talk about, for me is the fact the Doctor and Perry are trapped in the TARDIS for too long.
25 minutes.
That's right.
Yep.
And of course, Eric Saywood instructs his writers, well, what do we do? Well, we have to then have a bitch scene between them.
I actually suspect that that's Eric Saywood writing that scene. Am I right? Is there no way of knowing? But it's a really nasty thing. The one thing that I do like is Perry saying that he keeps burning the dinner and all of that sort of thing. And that's more of that Collins Doctor's incompetence at things and getting things wrong and being rather silly and a bit lovable. But I wish we'd kind of seen that rather than just having these giant wodges of unconvincing dialogue.
I do feel for them in that they have to act through this. The previous time I watched it out of order and I really detested that scene. This time, because of what's going on in the Twin Dilemma and their bumpy relationship, I got to the point where it was like, okay, enough now. Do I need to see any more? But then it stopped. Whereas the previous time, right from the beginning, I was just going, oh, please. So depending on what mood I'm in, I either go, well, I can live with it, or we've then got the wonderful plot device that the TARDIS is running out of this special ore, which can only be found on one planet, which you've never heard of before. Last week, didn't we have a special mineral that blew up the cyber control?
Yeah.
Bastille.
And 2 weeks before that, but 2 stories before that, we had Spectrox, the most valuable substance in the universe.
One of the most valuable substances in the universe.
But this one, you see, had a trademark.
Oh, okay.
So
my biggest criticism for the story is that TARDIS stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Colin, why does Colin, he just sort of becomes defeated and slumps into a chair and stuff. Mm. And it is, Saywood doesn't want us to have a hero. And he keeps keeping the Doctor out of stories. I don't know who's responsible for the structure here, and I'll talk more about it later when we talk about the story's resolution. But he keeps wanting to undermine Colin's Doctor all the time, and so have him sort of just petulantly slump in a chair and give up and talk about waiting for death. Like, that's in no way entertaining, and it damages the character. And the character keeps being damaged, and I don't think it's Colin's fault.
It's something I've criticized a much later story for, and that is, it's an effort to make the companion look intelligent and resourceful, but rather than just allowing Perry to be intelligent and resourceful, it has to come because the Doctor's being stupid.
Yeah.
But at the same time, watching these stories in order, something I'm picking up on is the Sixth Doctor's lack of self-esteem. And if you consider the character as being someone who actually lacks self-esteem, the tantrums and the despondency, but also the mania, start to make a little more sense. And you know what? Hand on my heart, I am sure I am reading something that isn't there, because Colin has never discussed that.
Yeah.
And Colin is very happy to discuss his character and his approach to the character. But if you look at his character as someone who is actually not very sure of themselves, suddenly the patchwork costume makes a lot of sense. He's saying, look at me, look at me, look at me, don't look at me, look at me, look at me, don't look at me. And I do think at least Nicola kind of rises to the fact that, you know, she brings in the TARDIS manual and throws it at him and tells him to stop sighing like a steam engine and feeling sorry for yourself. And then Perry's still taking on the role here of his nurse and his carer, you know. I'm not saying it's perfect, but I am saying there is some kind of value there. In terms of the structure of the story, this is, I was referring to last week, an example of where when you break them up into 25 minutes, it's really terrible, because the cliffhanger to episode one of this story is them arriving on Varos, the guard shooting at the TARDIS.
It's actually, I wonder who's coming towards us. That's the actual cliffhanger.
Oh, yes, you're right, you're right.
The
yes.
better cliffhanger would have been if he'd shot at the yes. TARDIS.
And then
it had gone to cliffhanger. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
But of course, it's one of these things where who's ever viewing the tapes just goes, okay, there it is, and doesn't bother to look 25 seconds either side
yeah.
to see
yeah.
is this better.
The episode 3 one is even worse, because it's during the transmogrification scene, right? And after they've shot the machine, they've run up to where they're transmogrified and they think it hasn't worked. And you think that's the perfect cliffhanger. Right. You know, you cut to Perry and Aretta and they're still in their beast forms, if you like. The actual cliffhanger is when it has worked and they pick them up off the thing. And Nicola has that beautiful line where she says, I thought I could fly. You know, she delivers it in such a delirious way. It's lovely. The Doctor responds, walking all is all that's required for now. What the hell is that? That is the worst cliffhanger in the history of the series.
I think that one is, because they just walk off the screen, don't they?
Yeah, they just start to walk off the screen.
That might be the worst one of these fake cliffhangers of the season. But I still hadn't twigged. As a kid, I still hadn't twigged that the structure was any different, because in the middle, you've got that episode 2 cliffhanger, which is Cut It Now, right?
Which is just spectacularly
it's
good.
Genius.
Yeah.
And, it's genius.
And so you get these cliffhangers that are the actual cliffhangers, and then you get one that's a bit dodgy and one that's probably crap, but I just didn't pick up on it.
So can we talk about that episode 2 cliffhanger? Because it's the Doctor in peril, which is what we expect from a cliffhanger, but instead of seeing it directly, we see it on television. We get the Governor doing the director's job and saying, cut it now. We get a laugh from Syl that bleeds over the closing credits, and the show dutifully obeys what the Governor's direction is and cuts as the Governor directs. And so it is that we're watching, people watching television with the Doctor in it, just as Eric and Etta are watching the Doctor on television as well while we're watching them. And the fact that in this story, and this story I think suffers from the problem that It's set in an artificial environment, the punishment dome, where all of the peril is kind of engineered and things. So it's a little bit too easy to come up with these sort of various different kinds of peril. And the peril is not generally very interesting or well realized. So sometimes it's a green light that makes you smile and walk off into the distance. Sometimes it's two green lights that aren't all that perilous after all. Sometimes it's like, I like the house fly. I think it looks really fabulous. Yeah, yeah. But all of those artificial video game perils that you just have to overcome one after another.
But you do have to consider that element is of its time. And I'm glad you brought up video games. It's partially cashing in on that. It's also cashing in on the rise of horror movies on video and the fact that rating systems had yet to catch up with the home video market. Getting back to something you said about the green lights, two of them. I think that's so brilliant because so often in Doctor Who we've had alien creatures just expressed by lights, most recently the Garm, you know, who starts off as two lights. It subverts because we're expecting it to be this monster and then older viewers are probably like, yeah, it's going to be a crap monster. And the Doctor goes, no, it really is just two lights on a stick.
But you see what it's saying about the show. Do you know what I mean? If Arik and Etta are essentially watching Doctor Who of this period, what they're tuning in for is just a series of kind of unmotivated threats that the Doctor defeats or initially succumbs to and then maybe defeats. And increasingly those threats are nasty. And Arik and Etta are, you know, they're quite sweet, but they're also pretty bloodthirsty as well. You know, they're discussing scenes where people are blinded, executions, all of that sort of thing. And so this is, I think, a fairly savage attack, not only on us as viewers for still watching this crap, but also on the show itself. And not just this era, but, you know, the show is a show about various things assailing the Doctor, people being killed, bloodthirsty things, and here we all are enjoying it like Arik and Etta.
I sometimes wonder if it is a satire on a bloodthirsty audience or if it's a satire on the kind of people who now say that violent video games beget violence. Because as a gamer, I am constantly exposed to that idea. I have a friend who is a primary school teacher who got in a discussion with me about that once. He's like, you're an ex-teacher. How can you enjoy playing video games when they cause this violence and I see it in my students? And I'm kind of like, well, actually, no, there's lots of studies that say that just watching violence does not itself make you violent.
I actually worry about ragtime music causing violence.
Not to mention reefer madness.
Yeah.
Well, this is all very deep. I just sit there and if violence happens, well, you know how bloodthirsty I was.
Like, yeah, that's right.
So I'm one of these people that just says, yes, give me more of it, give me more of it. But to be quite honest, you know, at the time, I think there's a lot of Hollywood movies around this time that it's all now guns and violence and this is what we are, you know. Maybe I'm desensitized to it. I don't know. I don't know if I really thought about it on that level.
And I think that's the best kind of commentary, the commentary that doesn't exactly tell you what to think, but just the commentary that makes you think.
Mm. I think it is a strangely revealing kind of picture of the show.
Mm. I think if nothing else, it is asking the audience to consider what they watch.
Yeah.
Mm. And in a way, one of its antecedents is Nigel Neill's The Year of the Sex Olympics. This is from the same writer as Quatermass, etc. And the concept of it was a world where reality TV has become the norm. I mean, God, awful people who work in reality television. Mm. And this show has started and it's about a young couple with a baby and they're living in this desolate environment. And the idea is they're going back to basics. They don't have their technology and everyone at home is watching them live, et cetera, et cetera. And then a psychopath breaks into the studio. And rather than stop the psychopath, they're like, well, let's find out what happens next. So the weird thing is, I believe in the context of the show, The Year of the Sex Olympics is another show, a competing show that they're referring to that they never show on screen because this is 1968, but everyone else is watching this survivalist show and wondering if this young couple in this snowbound wasteland and their young baby is going to survive being in the same environment as a psychopath and they don't know it's there. But this idea of presenting a TV show or film where we're watching other people watching it, it's something that's never really gone away since then. You know, we've had The Truman Show, we've had The Matrix, which was about beings watching humans as entertainment. Doctor Who's done it again.
In perhaps my favourite story ever, Bad Wolf, The Parting of the Ways, which I just think is wonderful and also creates a dystopic future society by critiquing the things that they watch on television. And it kind of stretches the absolute boundaries of realism by having those things be exactly what we were watching on television in 2005. But those things are terribly funny. Mm.
I think that's part of the reason I will always like the story and I will always rate it highly. It may not be perfect in its execution, and I certainly think there are pacing issues, as we've previously discussed, but it is an attempt to do something really quite new and interesting and of the time. And something we discussed in our Peter Davison retrospective a few weeks ago is quite often they're just doing Doctor Who stories because we make Doctor Who stories and that's what we do, and it's not really about social commentary. You were saying earlier when we were recording, Todd, that you I think you really like this story. I quite enjoy it, and Nathan thinks it's terrible.
Well, so I think it's got some things going for it, but I think it has really serious problems that I think often go unacknowledged. I mean, I think this is a fairly highly regarded Colin Baker story, and I think there must be quite a few people for whom this is their favourite story. Just get your shot glasses ready. But Sandifer thinks that this is perhaps the only Colin Baker story that might be accorded the status of a classic. But I just think it has some flaws in it that really, really spoil that. And I want to start by referring to John Darr and Aretha.
Oh, dear God. Jason Connery. And I don't even know her name. I don't even want to know her name.
I don't think, does she? She does eventually get
A name
in episode two.
Oh, no, 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 her acting.
Yeah, the actor, but Aretha is just ancient Greek for virtue, I think. And they're both blonde, aren't they? So they're heroes.
She is Geraldine Alexander.
Mm. I think the thing with them is that they're so cardboard and wooden.
Yeah.
But listeners, I'm just going to say that. I quite like the fact that they're so earnest beyond all earnest. Like, you know, they both have some speeches somewhere in one of their rooms. She in particular has this thing which you could be reading from the telephone directory. Yeah. You know,
it's a really badly written speech and it's really poorly delivered. And John Darr gets to do speeches as well. And I think the show is making fun of them. I mean, they're both poor performances. And I know that Jason Connery has gone on to do other things and I don't think he's necessarily a terrible actor, but he is terrible in this. But the moment where he comes upon the cannibals in nappies, who really, really deserve to be mentioned to anyone who calls this story a classic, the moment he comes up to the cannibals in nappies and says, "Fellow prisoners," and then Colin shuts him down and tells him it's no time for political speeches, I think that that's the moment where it becomes clear that they're being satirized.
Is it too late to change the name of the podcast to Cannibals in Now?
Okay. So Ron Jones directed this. That is one of the most bizarre choices in the history of Doctor Who.
Yeah.
Cannibals in nappies. Like, what the?
And we do see them before that because Arik and Etta are watching them punch one another on television.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And when one of them is killed, the other one drags him back to his lair to eat, presumably later.
Which I just think's hilarious. I actually sit there and I just laugh at it. I just laugh at it.
Yeah. What I find so odd about the cannibals in nappies is, I suppose it's about subverting expectation. You know, you might expect them to be physically fit if they're constantly killing people and eating them, but they're these two mid-50s balding bank managers from Worthing.
Yeah,
you know?
They're terrible.
It's an odd choice.
I like my cannibals in bright colours and lovely cardigans, I have to say.
Well, I think we'll get that in a couple of years' time.
I actually think Jason Connery gets better through this when he's not paired with her of the perm. Like, that perm that she has makes her look at least 10 years older than him. I'm just going to say that.
But it's very 80s, though. It is a thing. It's very period.
Mm. Besides those two performances, which I think aren't great.
I think Rondel and Maldak are both terrible as well.
Oh, I actually think they're quite good.
Rondel's killed quite quickly, yeah, which is a relief.
No, I quite like Owen Teal as Maldak because, you know, especially when the governor is appealing to him to let Perry go, there is some interiority there and he is thinking it over. Mm. And thankfully, Owen Teal, who played him, has gone on to have a very long career. He's appeared in Torchwood, but we won't hold that against him. Actually, he's quite good in Torchwood. He's in Countryside.
Oh, really?
He's the one who, at the end, when Gwen asks him why he's done what he's done, he just says to her, because I enjoy it.
Wow.
And he's played a villain in a few things, and he's actually
Game of Thrones.
Game of Thrones. He is Sir Alistair Thorne, Jon Snow's antagonist in The Night's Watch, and he is brilliant in it. Because it is sometimes difficult for people to watch Game of Thrones, I won't spoil too much his role in season 5 and 6, but he takes an action which, as a viewer who likes Jon Snow as you're meant to, you immediately are opposed to him in that action. But when he explains his motivation for it, an objective person will have to look at that and say, look, working with what you believe and the facts you have, you can understand his action. And Owen Teal plays that really well. So he's become a very experienced actor. In Jason Connery's defense, I believe this was his first television.
Right.
And it wasn't long after this that he started doing his Robin Hood series, in which he is much better.
Right, okay. And he plays Ian Fleming, I think, in something later in a film or something. Is that a thing?
I wouldn't be at all surprised.
Look, I think he's quite pretty. And although I
he's only got 1.5 abs on each side visible above those high-waisted pants. I think it's a terrible waste.
He is. I've just ignored
Thank you, I'm here sorry, all week. Todd.
I'm sorry. Do carry on, Todd. And I'm sorry, dear listener.
Like we pointed out, the performance isn't stellar, but neither is it like one that I, you know, I've ranted about other people how pathetic they've been recently in The Twin Dilemma. Like it's nowhere near that.
No.
But I think that's because there's other people around that I really like. I think Martin Jarvis as the governor, his performance is amazing.
Yes.
And, and his relationship with Perry and what Nicola has to do in those scenes and Syl,
yeah,
Nabil Shabin is just amazing. I think.
So can we discuss each of them in turn? I really think Martin Jarvis lifts this, and he is probably going to be my favourite guest actor of the Colin Baker period. I think he's just terrific. He was one hell of a great Monoptera all those years ago. Butler in Invasion of the Dinosaurs. He's really, really good here. And people talk about the nobility of his character, but in fact he's a really horrible person.
Yes.
And he is kind of Tony Blair, who's, you know, going to rescue us from decades of Tory government, because he's utterly lacking in principle. He is prepared to organize executions in order to take the heat off himself. He's completely happy to sell torture videos to other planets. And yet when Syl appears to be enjoying the videos he's watching, he has the gall to kind of sneer at Syl. And one of the things that I maybe like about this story is in fact that Varos is left at his mercy at the end of it. And I have no confidence that the Doctor has solved that planet's problems.
See, I think Martin Jarvis's governor character goes on a little bit of a journey because there is the seed in his mind at the beginning of the story that what is happening on Varos is wrong. Like when it backs suggests the torture method and execution method for Jondar to neutralize the Q switch and build up the laser.
Mm.
The governor is visibly disgusted by that idea, and the chief, who's played rather wonderfully by Forbes Collins, just says...
I like the chief too.
The chief is great. And who's the other guy with the...
Quillam. Nicholas Chagrin.
I think he's really good too. Yeah.
I actually think that he is one of the worst things about this story.
But when the chief objects to the execution, it's simply because, oh, it'll be too quick.
Too quick.
No
Not
one
entertaining
will notice it.
Enough.
Later on, when the governor has been chatting to Perry, has shared a little joke with her about Syl's translation unit, like, don't tell him his translator doesn't work, it's my only source of amusement. And Perry begins to see this could be a sympathetic person, and then he says, we'll use the girl to get to the doctor. And she says, I thought you were better than these other brutes. He is visibly hurt by that. And you said earlier, Nathan, that perhaps the Doctor doesn't have much of an impact in this story. Perhaps he doesn't, but I believe that the Governor's change in character is because for the first time in his life, he's met someone who cares for others more than herself and her own self-preservation. And I think that slowly changes him over the course of the second episode.
I would hope that that's intentional, that that's really visible, because one of the glaring problems with this story is that it seems to me that if the Doctor and Perry had gone somewhere else, that things would have played out pretty much the same as they did. The only reason that the Governor is able to kind of change the political system and throw off their oppressors, like the Galatron Mining Corporation has been ripping them off and oppressing them and buying their stuff cheaply. In fact, the only reason that that situation changes is, firstly, the Governor persuades Maldak to let him escape, and then secondly, a series of messages appear on the screen saying that by chance we found another source of Zyton 7 on Biosculptor, and now you just have to pay the people of Varos as much money as they ask. So, in fact, the Doctor has absolutely nothing to do with that, and the plot is completely resolved by a few messages from the Galatron Mining Corporation appearing on the screen. And even when that happens, Martin Jarvis is so stupid that he only increases, he's seen that message, and he increases the asking price from 7 to 20. When it was like, pay any price, go. I'd be going up to, you know, 1,000, 2,000 a unit, you know. So the Doctor absolutely has no role in resolving anything that happens here. And that is a big problem under Eric Saywood generally. And I think this is the worst example of it.
It's a shame, because it would have been very simple to solve it by saying that the Doctor sent a message to somewhere he knew had Zyton and said, hey, tell this planet, tell this corporation you've got it to take the heat off this planet. You know, that would have been a simple way to fix that, sadly.
In fact, the big hero moment where he resolves things is where he instructs Jondar and Areta to fling poisonous vines at Quillam and the Chief. Do you know what I mean? And that's unpleasant. That's not particularly heroic. He doesn't actually do anything, and he encourages them to kill some people. And I just think that the show now has a big problem with the Doctor being a hero, that Saywood doesn't believe in heroes. No one in this story is a good guy at all. And now that's not even the Doctor. You know, not even the Doctor gets to fix the problem. And we saw it in season 21. It's not purely a Colin Baker phenomenon, but it's increasingly something that the show does, and I think it's a bad mistake. It just becomes the Doctor turns up somewhere and a whole bunch of science fiction things happen and then he leaves. Do you know what I mean? It's no longer the Doctor turns up somewhere, overthrows the government in an evening, and then he leaves. I love those stories, you know. The show has no shape. There's no reason for us to be interested in what the Doctor's doing. And Saywood certainly doesn't think that, because everything's about these environments that he's created and the tertiary characters that he's peopled them with.
Very insightful. I think that's a really good take on the core structure of Eric Saywood's time as script editor. One of the things is that the Doctor's constantly going on a holiday, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I can see where you're coming from with that. I do think that without them arriving, then Jondar wouldn't have got away and a series of events wouldn't have occurred to put the Governor in the position for change to happen, right? So even though their impact on what's going on is quite minimal.
Yeah, I mean, you need to structure the story around the Doctor solving a problem.
That doesn't worry me.
Yeah.
Okay, listeners, it doesn't worry me. I like the fact that they're there, involved with these trials, it's been commented on, and things happen. And, yeah, maybe they haven't had the impact, but I enjoy so many of the characters.
Yeah.
I enjoy Colin's performance in this once they get to the, or even in the TARDIS scene, I still think, you know, he's doing a good job with a situation that's not great. Two of my favourite sequences, well, three of them. One is the joke of Perrier at the end.
I love that.
Which I didn't get as a kid, yeah. And I just think is lovely. And there's a warmth there with the characters.
Okay.
Once they have their bitch scene, this is the thing, once they have their bit of tete-a-tete over and done with in episode one, you know, when they both fling their heads around the, what is it?
Around the corner, going hi.
You know, there's more
warmth. Yeah, that's really cute.
There's more warmth. And throughout, you know, he is concerned about Perry. I think one of the biggest criticisms of the era is his lack of concern for her and their relationship. But I again think in this that it's generally quite good. I mean, yeah. And even in the last story, yeah. It is quite good.
I think I said about the Twin Dilemma that it actually leads up to a climax where we see the Doctor, who has been really horrible, express concern for Perry. Do you know what I mean? I think that that's something that they try to turn around quite quickly.
So they're two of my favourite moments. The other one I really love, and you probably will disagree with me, is the hanging scene. And I really like Colin's performance leading up to it.
I think it's wonderful.
And I always forget about it. Like, I'm going, why is the Doctor acting like it's just slightly, there's something just slightly not right. And he's twigged as to what's going on. Again, Colin's come in. He's got the energy of a new Doctor. You know, he knows what he wants to do, right? Mm-hmm. Even if the writing is not always where it needs to be. And, you know, I say to any naysayers out there, you watch that scene.
The bit where Martin Jarvis asks him, like, if he wants to make a statement or have a last request or something, and he's not listening, like, he's just pretending not to listen, and then he sort of suddenly reacts, I think he's really good. Again, I think he does give a sort of fairly unfortunate political speech, which is poorly written, the poor quality of which is only kind of amplified by the theatricality of his performance. But I think he's really doctorish in that scene.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
There's something, like, he does... He nails doctorish.
He nails doctorish in a way that his predecessor didn't do for me.
He didn't very often for me either, but he does sometimes, I think.
Oh, I'm not saying he doesn't, but I'm just saying in this context, having gone through 3 years of not doctorish, I've latched onto this as a kid, right?
Yeah.
And those doctorish moments throughout this season are there for me, right? And the other flaws... writing, character or whatever, don't have much of an impact. I mean, I quite like a lot of the dark humour and the sort of some of the put downs and that sort of thing. That's me. I actually quite like that in movies and that sort of thing. And I know that a lot of fans don't really like that and it's not for them.
Yeah.
The whole thing with Colin's Doctor being a bit more unpredictable and a bit more violent, I think is a crystallisation of trying to address the problems with the Davison characterization and the gentleness of that. A scene I love so much in this story is when Perry and Aretta are under that transmogrification beam and Jonda is, I won't say beside himself because Jason Connery doesn't quite convey that, but is very concerned and shouting. And the Doctor's just having a nice conversation with Quilliman. Oh, and how does this work? And oh, and what kind of laser are you using? And then grabs a gun and points it at Quillam. And Quillam's like, well, you need me to operate the machine. And the Doctor's like, oh, it's that machine, is it? And blows up the machine. Mm. I think that is a wonderfully doctorish thing to do. I don't really have a problem with the Doctor pointing a gun at someone as a dramatic device. And something that often happens in the 80s, the Doctor's pointed a gun at a few people, and it is used as a dramatic device to varying effect. I think the best time it's been used is when the Doctor then gives his gun to Commander Vorschach in Warriors of the Deep.
Yeah.
But I think this is a wonderful heroic moment on the Doctor's part in that it shows how different he is to his predecessor and also shows the lengths he's willing to go to rescue Perry. The thing with the vines, it is an uncomfortably violent moment from the Doctor, but the other thing is, the Doctor has always stated he is averse to violence, but he has no problem with people performing violence on his behalf. Even if we were to look at the second Doctor, who is arguably the least violent Doctor we've had.
Except for the time that he shoots all those ice warriors.
Shoots all those ice warriors, rams a lawyer's head into a desk, etc.
Well, that's
but
fun.
That's the thing. As soon as he's got Jamie, he's quite happy for Jamie to run around clobbering people and stabbing people. The fourth Doctor says to Leela, stop stabbing people, about 3 weeks after he's punched a chauffeur unconscious in a gravel pit. So the Doctor has never been averse to violence. And in that scene with the vines, I think it's very important to note that the Doctor does not approach Quillam and the Chief. It's almost the whole Russell T. Davies' 10th Doctor thing of the Doctor has to walk up to the villain and say, you need to leave or I'm going to do something.
Yeah,
that's what's happening here. The Doctor is in an area that they know have the poison vines.
How does he know the vines are poisonous?
Yeah, I believe he identifies the scientific name of them when they walk in. He says, okay. Oh, it's blah, 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 blah.
All right.
Even though the Doctor orchestrates the trap, he's very clearly upset that he has to pull it. You know, he is very quiet and subdued afterwards and let's get away from here. And there's the infamous acid bath scene, which, as Colin says, if you watch it, the doctor with the trolley bed between him and the attendant, Colin is pulling.
It really doesn't look like that. And I did keep an eye out for it. It looks like he's trying to push the guy in.
No, he doesn't. He's actually trying to defend himself.
Yeah.
And that's what I see every time. As a kid, I saw that. One of the things that's really annoyed me over the years is when I came into fandom, there was this thing where it says the doctor pushes these people into the acid bath. Hmm. Well, no, he gets up. The first person is a fool and gets startled and falls in. And then his assistant just turns around and starts to go for the doctor. And the doctor's actually defending himself. I see that every single time. And then the other person pulls the other guy in.
Yeah, that is what happens. But I think that the fight scenes in this story are ineptly directed, just generally. And it's Ron Jones, for God's sake.
He can't direct fights.
He can direct traffic, though, because there's those little carts. But it does look like the doctor's trying to push him in. And I think that it's a mistake to show the guy with all his skin dissolving off, coming up to pull the other guy in. Because, A, why would he do that? And, B, like, yuck.
Well, that's the thing. He's not trying to pull the other guy in. He's just trying to pull himself out. You're desperate. You're grasping. I think the biggest problem with that scene is, do you mind if I don't join you? That is cruel and callous. And that is the complete opposite of the scene I just mentioned where the doctor is upset with what he's had to do to Quillam and the chief.
He does a moment of little horrified acting where he thinks about it for a second.
Yeah, but the thing is, it's not really horrified. It's more, oh, I'm not eating that. You know, it's kind of mild irritation.
I disagree with you.
I actually think
he downplays it. And it's a dark moment. Mm. I'm not going to disagree. Yeah. But he could have been what people think, like really like enjoying that. I actually think it's his way of sort of trying to justify in his head what's just happened.
Yeah.
That's my personal reading of it. And look, of course, should it have been shot the way it was shot? Should it really have happened? Probably not.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I remember as a kid watching various Hollywood movies and a lot of henchmen get dispatched in sort of cruel, sort of humorous ways, like, you know, sucked into aeroplane propellers and then the hero has some sort of witty line. And I can sort of see, listeners, I'm sorry, I'm just going to give up here and just say, look, I've got a dark sense of humor. And every time I watch that scene, I have no sympathy for those attendants. I think they're absolute fools. And, I'm sorry. I know you're laughing, Nathan, but I just sit there and I just actually just go, well, you're an idiot, you know. I'm sorry, you brought it upon yourself. There you go, boom, and you're going to attack the doctor now. Well, good luck. And I have no problem at all with him even saying that.
I'm just imagining those two attendants having a chat 5 minutes before that saying, so I asked for them to put a rail around this pool of acid and they're not going to. Do you know why? Why? Because they say we'll be leaning on it. Oh, well, wouldn't that have been wonderful to have a scene like that?
The vine scene I actually had more problem with.
Yeah,
really?
That's
a contradiction because all of those people die, right?
Yeah. Mm.
Even the two in the background. They didn't need necessarily the two other guards. It could have just been those horrible two that have caused a lot of problems. But, you know, in context of the new series where Russell T has gone about the Doctor uses other people as weapons, it's just, you know, and the Doctor doesn't do it all the time, whether it be, you know, blowing up fleets of things or whatever. He does use other people and that's the vine scene.
And rather darkly, had the Chief and Quillam been left alive, they're in Syl's pocket. With them gone, Syl has no power on Varos.
Okay. But I mean, he is then undermined by the Galatron Mining Corporation anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Interestingly enough, over on the A-Team, which is still in competition with Doctor Who at this point, we do have lots of guns. The big thing, though, about the A-Team and the thing everyone comments on is the A-Team themselves never shoot people. They only shoot cars. They shoot cars off the road. And then when the car goes off the road, they have to have a shot showing everyone getting out of the car. So it's like the A-Team's thing was violence and explosions, but very visibly showing, no one's died from this, which is exactly the kind of thing Eric Saywood argues against. He says, if you're going to fire a gun, you have to show the violent impact of that act to get across that firing guns is bad.
See, that's why I just think you don't do it in Doctor Who. There's no blood in New Who just about for the first, like for the whole Russell T. Davis era. I think we get a bit of blood where the Master gets killed in Last of the Time Lords. There's still terror and violence. There's stakes. There's people who get killed. But there's just a kind of relentless nastiness to the program at the moment, which I don't like. And there is occasionally humor, but Eric Saywood can't write good jokes. I think the best joke is the ad-libbed Perrier joke, which is just the Doctor being sort of rather sweet and silly. I think there's something unpleasant about this story.
The other joke that was cut, which is rather terrible, you can find it on the DVD. So originally the whole what are we going to do, Dano thing with the static screen wasn't the final shot. There was a shot back in the TARDIS with the Doctor saying to Perry, look, are you feeling okay after what you've been through? And she says, well, aside from the residual effects of foul pest, I think I'll be fine.
To which has been our second foul pest joke of the era.
Which leads the Doctor then to say, well, so long as you stay away from millet and cuttlefish, and they have a Scooby-Doo laugh and the title's cut in.
Oh, God.
And it's not Colin and Nicola's fault. It's a horrible script, and it really undermines the whole what are we going to do, dunno, ending, which is lovely and memorable.
Well, I actually like how both episodes end with a shot of a television screen.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
One with a cliffhanger on it and one with static.
Mm.
And, you know, the static at the end just makes us think of the hiatus. Like, what's going to happen? We've got no Doctor Who for 18 months. What
but
are we going to do with
ahead
ourselves?
Of ourselves? So we do, of course, have Syl.
Who I think is actually pretty good, and I'm not surprised that he comes back next year.
Mm.
I think he's sort of funny. I think the laugh that he does is really good. He looks like a turd that's been working out, doesn't he, really? He's got a pointy end, you know, he's sort of a bit some upper body sort of muscles and stuff.
He is proper buff-like.
You're a lying liar. And I love the fact that he finds Perry revoltingly ugly.
Yeah.
Like, it's just, I just find that so funny because, like, she's a beautiful woman. Yeah.
And also, you know, throughout this era, she's going to be sleazed on by aliens. Mestor thought she was really hot stuff. So it's kind of nice, a little bit of a relief, in fact, that Syl doesn't find her attractive as well. Yeah.
And then he's got his buff attendants with him, you know.
I just think that's appalling. And is it the only time that black people appear in this season?
Oh.
It may be the only one of them gets to say the word right. So it may be the only black person with a speaking part. And all they are is slaves in fetish gear. And, you know, we complained about that in Terror of the Autons because of poor old Roy Stewart. But, you know, it's much later. It's the 80s now, and that's not really defensible, I think.
I'm going to go out on a limb here and say it is a problem for the season. I don't think it's a problem for this story because it very quickly tells you through visual identification, through the fact that these are two black actors, it's only a few years after Roots, which was, of course, watershed television. It is telling you that Syl has slaves and that is wrong, and therefore he is a villainous character. I had not considered that these are the only two black actors in the season, and I agree with you that that is appalling representation.
I hadn't considered it either, and I think that they wouldn't even have considered it.
Like, no, but that's the problem.
Like, they just didn't think about it.
No, and that's what I'm saying is the problem. The problem is that we have two slaves to cast, we'll cast black people, and that's the only time we think of doing that this year. And the 80s... Doctor Who isn't that great in the 80s as far as representation of sort of minorities is concerned. And it does get a bit better when Sylvester McCoy comes along. Mm. But then there are sort of slightly embarrassing token things like the Ringmaster in Greatest Show of the Galaxy. But I do think that it's not really good enough. And those guys too, they're in the backgrounds of shots and they're just staring into the distance. You know, they're barely people. They're scenery. And I really think that that's bad. And I think it's no better next year when it turns out that Thoros Beta is the planet of black people who carry slugs around the place.
I will say, getting slightly ahead of ourselves next year, though, that Frax and Madame Catriona are characters.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. In a way that these guys don't get
to be.
Yeah,
exactly. A word on Nabil Shabin, of course, who has been a Doctor Who fan since the Hartnell era. His first Doctor Who story was the first Dalek story while he was in hospital.
Right.
So he is an actor with a condition called osteogenesis imperfectica, which meant his legs didn't develop.
Right.
The slug tail are his legs. So for me, as I look down, I'm looking at the top of my thighs, that is essentially the extent of his legs.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, he was in that, and I think he kind of describes it as being like a mermaid tale. And initially he was going to be submerged, partially submerged in that tank, but they couldn't figure out a way to make it work, so they just perched him on top instead.
I like how he calls upon the attendants to moisturize him, though.
Water me?
Water me!
I need to look the best, best for the sort of upcoming conference call.
I find the heat of this Varos-type world most unpleasant, or something along those lines.
I think he's fun. I think he's the most Doctor Who-ish thing in the story.
It's kind of the thing we would come to expect from David Tennant, in that he's an immense fan of the show, so he puts in 5,000% into his performance and is thus magnificent.
Yeah, the laugh is really great, and it was a great idea to end episode one on that laugh.
Yeah.
It's wonderful. And it's the sort of thing you can imitate in the playground.
Oh,
yeah. It's precisely
and we did.
It.
It sticks in my mind to this day.
Yeah, he's the first imitable villain and indeed alien in ages. I'm trying to think of another villain you might... Well, I think I remember you saying, Todd, that you and your sister would imitate the Mara, Tegan's Mara voice.
Yeah, but that's more of a person rather than...
Yeah.
We used to do lots of Skibus and Tarpok, I think, back in the 80s, I seem to remember.
Excellent, Skibus!
But I don't think... We didn't do them on the playground, but this was the first one, the John Nathan Turner era, really, that, you're doing in the playground.
Yeah, they haven't done great monsters, have they? Yeah, and I think everyone since then, like in the new series, they're very careful, and Moffat in particular is particularly good at introducing and creating new high concept, monsters and aliens, but... It's really not something that the program's been interested in for a while. Yeah. And Syl's more of a character than a race of aliens, really.
Mm, yeah. Although we will get to see more of his race next year, because JNT was so taken with Nabil's performance. Because really, Nabil creates the mentors here.
Yeah.
And creates the idea that they're this ruthless mercantile race. Shortly before production wrapped, John Nathan Turner sent a memo to, I believe it was the props department, saying, please retain the costume and the water tank. I intend to revisit the character.
And they disobeyed because he comes back in a different costume and without the water tank?
They did keep it, but they decided to do a new one.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, the stuff was kept.
I think the second costume is a little bit more successful. There's a sort of fin thing around his face, which...
obscures the join.
Yeah, there's a bit of a problem with the helmet and the face and all of that sort of thing, and I think they do a better job of it next time. I'm not sure about the bright green next time, but, it's not the costume so much as the performance that's fun, and it is, it's a fairly bog-standard satire of sort of slimy mid-80s capitalism, and that's something that will be played up a lot more, actually, in his next appearance next year.
So speaking of costumes, the Doctor actually gets out of his coat during this story, like for quite a bit of it. I like the fact that the coat's not there for a bit, I think the coat works better when it's on alien worlds. I know you didn't like it last week.
It's bad on Earth.
But you see, last week I didn't have a problem with it because you're in the tombs, and even when they were running around London, they weren't interacting with many people, so it was just their own little subplot. Yeah. So I don't actually have a problem with that. And I like the fact that it gets ditched for a while here, which is a good thing. But
The costume that's left isn't very flattering because it's got those big yellow pants that are worn up too high and then a big white shirt. And so he's wearing pale colours that really don't flatter him. And again, the second Doctor, third Doctor in a row, whose braces have question marks on them, which I just think is awful. So I don't like that. I'm going to be a big fan next week of the Flash's Mac that he steals and wears in Mark of the Rani, and I would have liked to have seen him wear that a little bit further. And actually, I suspect that Colin would have been more comfortable in that as well.
I think he probably would have too.
There is actually a very hopeful moment where he starts trying on Quillam's clothes but gets interrupted just a little too soon, thankfully.
Oh, can we talk about Quillam?
Unfortunately, I should say.
You don't like him?
No. I think that the standard disfigured scientist guy is tired. He's kind of a fifth-rate Davros, really. Mm. I'm a bit exhausted by how he's coded as gay. there's extravagant hand movements, the way that he speaks. And that famous line, you know, I want to hear him scream until I'm deaf with pleasure. Like, he's camp. So I don't like the performance. He's got terrible Commander Data hair, which I guess is just part of the period. And I don't know what he's doing there. Do you know what I mean? I mean, his job is to run that transmogrification thing. But I think the transmogrification thing is a mistake. It's kind of a sci-fi B-movie conceit. And they were never, ever going to be able to pull it off in a convincing way. And so Perry with the gloves with feathers sewn onto them, it just looks stupid.
Oh, I think those look amazing. To talk about Quillam for a second, his performance changes when his mask gets ripped off. When he has the mask on, he's very calm and very controlled. As soon as the mask is ripped off, he's ranting and raving. And I think it ties in with that thing I was saying earlier about, is the Sixth Doctor a character with actually really low self-esteem who's acting out? And I think that's the case with Quillam. I think no one has seen him without his mask before, and now he is embarrassed and fighting because he's got this disfigurement, which is silly in and of itself. You know, it doesn't stand up to scrutiny. You would learn to live with it. But the transmogrification, especially the makeup on Geraldine Alexander as Aretta, the reptilian makeup, it is Star Trek The Next Generation level, which everyone was holding
maybe
up.
Maybe season one, Star Trek The Next Generation level.
But I really like Nicholas Bird makeup as well. Maybe it's just an eye of the beholder thing, but yeah. I think it's done really well. Physical disfigurement and transmogrification is an obsession for Philip Martin. It'll come up in his next Doctor Who story. He writes a story for Big Finish where it comes up again. Yeah. Much like Robert Holmes with Space Pirates, Power of Kroll and Caves of Androzani, Philip Martin writes one story for Doctor Who.
I don't mind the transmogrification at all. Yeah, the glove hand looks a bit. Yeah. But the rest of it I think is quite well done. I never saw the gay coder stuff in Quillam's performance as a kid. I just didn't see it, and yeah, I still didn't pick up on it now. I don't think it's necessarily there.
Can I say one thing in defense of one performance that people were talking about earlier? I quite like Aretta's info dumps at the beginning of episode one. I love her scene with Quillam. Or something truly loathsome such as you. It's so Shakespearean. But I also really love her scene with Rondel, because it is the unfortunate thing of she has to say things like, you know, the descendants of the officers still rule. It's an unfortunate line, but I believe the emotion she puts into it, and I believe the emotion that Rondel responds with. I think having a character called Rondel is a mistake in a series when you've already established the word Roundel.
He could have been called Fondle.
Fondle. No, that wasn't an instruction. Yeah. Although, you know, with him, I would. Anyway.
He's dead now. Have some respect, Brendan.
It's actually better than a lot of other info dumps in the era.
But the era has a tendency towards info dumps.
Yeah. I mean, we're going to hit the nadir of that in a few stories. All 500 of us.
It's not necessary. Do you know what I mean? It's not necessary. They're writing down to the audience. And the syntax of them is so deadening, you know. That example, something truly loathsome such as you, like who would say that? It doesn't need to be supernaturalistic, but it doesn't need to be quite so awkward. And next week it's going to get worse in a story that I think is less unpleasant than this one. But it has much more florid and preposterous dialogue than this one does.
Yeah, her performance. I'm sorry, in those scenes, it just doesn't sell. I'm sorry, it just doesn't, Brendan.
I mean, I think she just becomes a peril monkey after that point. Yeah, you know, she identifies the GG fly. She screams Jondar a lot. She doesn't stop Perry wandering off and getting caught in the buggy. Those buggies, you can tell when they've been sped up on the video disc. And yet they come back at least twice in the series different forms. It's ridiculous.
They're back in Happiness Patrol. And when else are they back?
I believe they are adapted in Mysterious Planet.
Okay.
They're cute, but they're ridiculous.
They're cute, but they're ridiculous. Yeah, but I don't mind them.
There's an attempt to make it seem a bit less studio-ish. Do you know what I mean? If you can drive vehicles around. It's like the horses in the studio in the Gunfighters, you know.
Yeah.
So this story, ratings, 7.2 and 7 million, which is, you know, pretty much in line with previous, but what's concerning is the placing, which is 108th and 110th. So obviously he's not even in the top 100 with 7 million, you know, and previous seasons with 7 or 7.5 million, it's like, you know, in the 80s or whatever. Looking at Pete's ratings and the ratings here is that a lot of Peter's episodes are either 7.6 or 6.6. Like there's this 1 million gap. Yeah. Mm. And the 7.6 is when he has like one around 7 million, it tends to be lower. So I reckon there's a lot of television shows that are between like 7 million and about 7.6. And if you hit the bottom scale of that, you'll suddenly push down a lot.
Yeah.
Whereas I think there is a big difference between 7 million and getting 7.6 million. I think there's a lot of shows that are probably in that.
Yeah.
Is Doc 2 going out?
It's going out at 5:20.
See, maybe the fact that it is earlier means that there might be, you know, a few hundred thousand viewers that aren't there.
It is sort of too early, is it?
Yeah, and I think at this stage they're still pitching the scripts for a later time slot.
Yeah, it does seem unusual to have people fall into baths of acid at sort of quarter to six on a weekend night.
Look, I just want to say you've brought up a lot of interesting points, Nathan. I have real respect for your insights. I think the biggest thing that you've brought up here is the fact that the Doctor's impact is minimal.
Mm.
And the fact that the slave guards are black men, and that, and I never even thought
and
about
indeed
it.
The only black actors in this season. For me, watching this again in order, the biggest problem of the era so far is that each story has tried to do something new and not quite succeeded. But I feel like at this point in the Davison era, we'd had Castrovalva, Four to Doomsday, and Kinder. And of those, I would only say Kinder is the most inventive of those. Whereas Twin Dilemma, for all its faults, Attack of the Cybermen, and this are all incredibly inventive, possibly to the detriment of the story. But I think that's possibly why I prefer Colin's era to Peter's, and I'll discover that more as I go along. But Colin's era, if nothing else, is always inventive. Well, dear listeners, we have refueled on Argonite / Spectrox / Methane / Zyton 7 / Tesla's electric motor. So we'll be taking off from the planet Varos now, heading to Kew Gardens in the 19th century. It's going to be a great trip. I'm so looking forward to it. Do come back next week for Mark of the Rani. You can find us online at flightthroughentirety.sexy, Flight Through Entirety on Facebook and iTunes, and at FTE Podcast on Twitter. Over on Bondfinger, we have the complete run of Sean Connery and Roger Moore James Bond films, as well as special guest stars David Niven and George Lazenby. That's in the films, by the way. They didn't come and watch them with us. You can find that at bondfinger.com, Bondfinger on Facebook and iTunes, and Bondfingercast on Twitter. I'm continuing to self-promote by telling you to go buy the wonderful book Hating to Love, which also includes essays from people such as J.R. Southall and Beth Ward and John Arnold, reassessing 52 of the worst ever Doctor Who stories. Which Colin Baker ones are in there? Well, you're just going to have to have a look at the book and find out. And finally, may none of your alien slugs get the runs after eating dyed peaches. Thank you very much for listening and good night.
Good night.
See you soon.
That was Flight Through Entirety with Todd Bealby, Nathan Bottomley and Brendan Jones. Theme arrangement by Cameron Lamb. This episode, Cardboard and Wooden, was recorded on January 15th, 2017. The next episode will be released on February 12th. Out now on Verosian Broadcasting Company Video, Nappy Cannibals Gone Wild Volume 7. Order now and receive a free copy of Synchronized Acid Bath Diving.
Like, I think there are good things in this story, but I think there are a lot of bad things as well.
Hmm.
A lot.
That's okay, because I think there's crap in this, but I enjoy it.
Yeah, yeah.
I enjoy pathetic performances.
Yeah. Who do you think is pathetic?
That woman, the wife.
Oh, Jesus Christ, she's bad.
Okay, could we save it?
They're a power couple of crap, but I love the fact that they're crap.
Yeah.